from runasradio.com, you're listening to Run As Radio, the internet audio talk show for IT professionals with Richard Campbell and Greg Hughes. This is Brandon Wen announcing show number 97 with guest Dana Epp, recorded Thursday, January 29th, 2009. Run As Radio is produced each week by Pwop Productions, providing professional media and podcasting services online at pwop.com. You can follow the boys on Twitter at twitter.com/runasradio.
This is Richard Campbell, and you're listening to Run As Radio. With me, as always, my co-host, Greg Hughes.
Hey, how's it going?
Good. We seem to be on a roll of security shows lately.
Yeah, that's okay.
You're not complaining. Yeah, it's your stuff, right?
Yeah, that's really what we should be doing, isn't it?
There's lots of stuff to talk about.
You can't have too much security.
Well, yeah, you can. There's a point at which there's no doors into the room.
Good point. Yeah, security is a way of doing business as opposed to should be the way a way of doing business and facilitating it as opposed to a way of shutting it down and making it impossible.
Right. That's what all you security guys say.
Yeah, that was my short soapbox right there. But yeah, you're right. We have had a good opportunity to talk about a number of different security threads and to touch on some, and we get to do that a little bit more today.
Yeah, and I'll get some love in the next few shows. And by all means, if you don't like security shows, you can send us an email, let us know, or if there's other topics you want to hear from, info@runasradio.com.
Yep.
All right, let's jump to our guest. It is Dana Epp. Let me see this bio here. Dana Epp researches software security and sets the corporate vision from the convergence of information security principles and practices with digital information asset production and Scorpion software. Holy cow, okay, he's a security geek.
Blah, blah, blah.
Dana!
How's it going, Dana?
I could tease my friend. We're from the same part of the world, right? We saw each other just last week at Tech Days.
Great. Where I was doing presentations on.
You were doing stuff on security, and I was talking about Vista Bridge, of all things, but nobody seems to know anything about it. I think it's the only way to actually make your apps look like they're Vista apps. Of course, now you have to wonder if that's actually a good idea.
Without actually making them Vista apps? Yeah.
Yeah.
So, Dana, what were you talking about the other week?
Well, I was talking about how to secure your virtual environment. So when people want to start utilizing Hyper-V in a deployment scenario, how to use things like ASMAN and the whole method of using Authorization Manager and bridging all that stuff together to provide finer grain role control so that when people need access to different VMs, they can get that without getting...
Cool. So you mean it's not like just automatically secure out of the box all by itself?
Well, Hyper-V is. It's got a lot of, you know, ways of managing it if you're in, like, a single-role environment where one person is dealing with it. The issue comes down when you want to have multiple people. Let's say you're a SQL database administrator. You want to have the ability to reboot your SQL box, and you need to do that at a console level because maybe something went wrong. Well, under a normal scenario, you'd have controls of the physical box, so you could do that. What do you do in a virtual environment, though? Normally, you'd have to give that person complete administrative credentials, which means they have access to every single virtual machine on the Hyper-V server, which is a big risk. And so you can use things like Authorization Manager and restrict it down so that SQL admin can only manage the SQL VM. And that's just something a lot of people don't know exists in Hyper-V, which gives it really nice security principles to apply to match up with.
Now, the way I hear you describe this, Dana, it sounds like we're talking about security specific to doing stuff with VMs. Don't the normal security roles, like in Exchange and in IIS, aren't they just the same in a virtual machine?
Well, in many cases they are, because when you treat what's going on in the operating system inside the child, yes, you're going to still apply the same security principles and practices to how you would lock down Exchange. The issues that come into play, though, when working in a virtualized environment is that there's lots of other considerations that need to be accounted for, like how do you deal with a file that can be just copied onto a USB drive and walked away? Normally, you don't worry about an Exchange server being picked up if it's some big-ass box in a, right, in a server room. But if you have the ability of simply copying a VHD file off of the Hyper-V server and then walking away with it, that's a different kind of risk you need to account for. Other things include things like if you're using System Center Virtual Machine Manager or any kind of a VM management tool where you're going to have VHDs that you might be able to roll back or apply. There are other concerns like, are you making sure that it's, when it comes back up into the environment, that it's up to date? Are all the patches applied? Are all the security paradigms you would apply to that server matching whatever your corporate security policy is? And it's kind of a risk that you have because sometimes you might have dormant VHDs. You know, like, let's say you're going to bring up a brand new Windows Server 2008 box, but you have a gold deployed VHD there that you're going to bring up and clone. As soon as you bring it up on the internet or on the network, if that is connected to the internet, they're exposed to any risk because it's not patched yet. Whereas in a normal brand new install, what's the first thing that happens? The security policy set it up so that no one can touch the server until all the updates are applied. So there's these kind of little nuances that you have to consider whenever you try to bring this stuff up. Yes, hardening the OS, hardening the applications, everything still exists, but then there's other considerations that need to be applied when you consider what you're trying
to do. Didn't I recently read that Microsoft made a tool where it's possible to patch a VM without sort of fully starting it up?
Sort of. What they've got is they've got an ability so that it will bring up a VM, apply the patches,
okay,
and then bring it back down. In the time that it comes up, though, it's going to be connected to the network. Well, depending on how it's configured, it will have the ability to be on that network. Now, what's nice is in SCVMM, and because that's behind the scenes, everything like SCVMM is driven through PowerShell. And so they've got these really sweet PowerShell scripts that can let you do things like when you bring this kind of stuff up in the VM, you can reconfigure it, you can reset it. So you could theoretically put it on a quarantine network that's maybe isolated with a threat management gateway, and you've got WSIS behind there, and then you could apply the patches and then bring it back down, and it won't touch it. And that's a good way of doing it. I'm more interested, though, that there's some research going on right now where they're looking to do that offline so that it doesn't even have to bring it up. Because at the end of the day, the VHD is in a manageable file that you could theoretically mount it read-only and apply it. There's some other things that make that much more difficult, like, you know, just some of the policy settings you need to apply to make that work. But I'm actually looking forward to when they have that day, because then that means stale VHDs that might be 2 years old that you're going to bring up as a base can always be up to date and patched, and they never have to.
Yeah, I'm just thinking about the battle there of maybe I've got a VM here that normally is part of a web farm, and I spin up new additional ones as I need more performance, and so I don't want that coming up to be patched and actually trying to join the pool when it does it. So I guess there'd be some tricks around how do I configure this so that I can bring it up, get the patches in, and bring it back down without it ever trying to do any of the things it was actually built to do.
Right, and that's one of the things that they've got with this I can't remember the actual name of what that tool is, but it just came out a couple of months ago. It's on TechNet for downloading, but it gives you the ability to do that, basically roll it up as long as you put it in an isolated state, right? Like, nothing prevents you from putting it on a special NIC that's not, you know, internet facing. The trick is making sure it can still get the patches you need to apply. So depending on how you use the tool, you might apply it directly, or, you know, the better way is to have something like a WSIS server that's up to date, that's isolated and quarantined in that environment so that you can, you know, accomplish what you need to. That's nice because you can actually do some very interesting things like, apply. What I would do in those kind of scenarios is one of the reasons I would like to use things like Windows Server 2008 and pretty much every VM we do now is that we can apply NAT policies. So we can actually have the system automatically quarantine itself because the NAT client policies will say, whoa, you're not patched.
Right.
We're isolating you until you do it.
Right.
So there's some other Microsoft technology you can apply at the same time. Unfortunately, that doesn't exist or it's extremely difficult to configure in things like Windows Server 2003. So there's a plug on why people should be using a lot of their VMs in
Are you seeing the adoption of Hyper-V going quickly? Like, I still see, of course, I'm working with Microsoft a lot. A lot of their sample stuff is coming out as virtual machine rather than Hyper-V.
I think part of that's just branding and recognition on there. At the end of the day, VHDs are VHDs, other than some internal components that you need to install. There's still virtual server, and more importantly, a lot of those test things that Microsoft's releasing is things like virtual PC, right, which are not Hyper-V. But, you know, the reality is we take a look at production servers. What are we going to use in an IT pro environment for rolling out production VMs? And what's interesting is that there's a lot of different statistics that have been put out there from lots of different study groups. Like, the one that I think is pretty cool is that IDC did a white paper that said that the number of virtual servers are going to rise from about 1.7 million right now to about 7.9 million by 2010. And that's going to jump to about 14.6% of all servers. If you think about that in the number, what that's saying is that for every physical server that's out there, they're expecting to have four right. virtual servers, or virtual machines. And it doesn't matter what we're using to do that, if that's Hyper-V or if that's virtual server or that's, you know, VMware, ESX, or if that's Zen, or at the end of the day, whatever that platform is going to be, we have a lot of virtualized machines that are going to be out here by 2010. So Hyper-V, Microsoft has rolled out a very good technology that makes a lot of sense. And I think the biggest issue is that you need to have Windows Server 2008, and that adoption curve for some IT people, it hasn't been there yet. It's coming, but, you know, you need Windows Server 2008 to use Hyper-V, and not everybody's done that yet. So that's a little bit of the, I think, where the issue is that Microsoft's trying to battle.
So I go to Dana Epp's really cool and awesome session or class on, you know, virtualization and security. What are the key concepts that you're trying to get across to me? What are the things that people really, really need to know?
Well, I think one of the key things is to understand where Hyper-V fits in the big role of things. Because, you know, there's some security goals that Microsoft had to put down when they were designing Hyper-V, which makes it entirely different than a lot of the other virtualization platforms that exist. Like, some of the things are that they did was they made sure that they were providing strong isolation between the partitions. So they cannot talk unless you do so through what I would consider a standard IT means. Like, if you need them to communicate via RPC, you're going to do that at the network layer. You're not going to have an ability to communicate directly from between VMs, which some of the platforms do allow you. Actually, there's some of the open source platforms, it actually gives you the power that as you're spinning up a VM, you can directly manipulate this stuff inside it. Microsoft said, no way. You would not do that in a production environment because that breaches that isolation. And it also then allows you to guarantee the confidentiality and integrity of the data because nothing can touch it unless, you know, it meets the standard operating system mechanisms for authorization and authentication and all the other pieces that's there. And because it's all separated, they have such a small hypervisor. The actual hypervisor that runs this whole core thing is like about 850K. Whereas if you look at something like ESX and that, I think it's about 32 megabytes. And the reason is that they've got all this drivers and all this other stuff that's in there. And that, from a security standpoint, when we think about things like patch management and driver management and that, there is not this really interesting isolation between the parent and the children partitions. And that's been something that's been very, very critical, I think, because people didn't realize that Hyper-V was designed that way, which it does make it much safer. The other part to it, though, I think more critical is people trying to understand how to secure the parent partition. That's the most critical thing when we talk about Hyper-V. And my session at Tech Days was specifically on how do you secure that parent? Because there's some critical pieces that you can do which are needed from everything from how you install Hyper-V. A lot of people don't know that Windows Server Core was designed in a way so that you can deploy Hyper-V and significantly reduce the attack surface of the, of the base partition, like the parent partition. Because you're actually removing all of those binaries that don't need to be used. And why that's important is if you take a look at, let's say, Microsoft Virtual Server that's run on Windows Server 2003, every update to Windows Server 2003 meant that you would have to bring down the entire box because you have to bring every VM down and the host and reboot. Well, okay, that's going to happen even in Windows Server 2008. But if you're running Core, the actual attack surface is significantly reduced because there's simply no binaries there. So you go from, you know, a base install of 3 to 6 gigabytes down to 1 gigabyte. And the main core reason is that all the applications are gone. There is no UI. There is nothing to update. And that makes it, you know, much, much safer because, A, from a productivity point of view, you're not bringing the box down all the time. And B, is that if there was a vulnerability that is found in that base system, it's much more difficult to exploit if there's literally nothing running on there. And that's one of the things I'm actually kind of scared of. I see people running, doesn't matter what virtualization platform they're using, their parent partition, they're installing stuff. They're like making it their domain controller. And I'm just screaming at them going, what are you doing? You don't run rolled services other than the virtualized stack in that parent because you need to isolate it and make it basically do nothing but the virtualization.
Now, that being said, you do need one physical AD server at least somewhere in your network.
Well, there's ways you can do it. You can. There's nothing that says you cannot virtualize your Active Directory infrastructure. I would just highly recommend that you have at least one physical read-only domain controller as a secondary in case the virtualized one has a fault or failure. Because, you know, at the end of the day, like I look at our organization, we're a pretty small organization, so we're running Small Business Server. And what we've done is we've got Small Business Server 2008 running in a virtualized environment, but then we have a small, really, really old box that's a read-only domain controller running Windows Core as a failover. So if the, you know, the SBS VM doesn't come up, we still can at least log in and get access to stuff and fix it if we needed to.
Well, and I'm just thinking about that host machine needing to come up in the domain. There needs to be a domain controller somewhere.
That's right. Well, it's in a cache mode, right? So you can still, even if the DC is not quite up yet, one of the tricks you can do is you can easily configure the VMs so that in the order precedence and how that all comes up, the parent itself doesn't, it doesn't matter because it can wait for the DC to come up. You just got to make sure all the other VMs and everything else don't start. And, you know, there's an order precedence and a timing. You can basically delay the start so that the DC can get up and you can, you know, get up and running. And in the case of, you know, something goes wrong, if you have that read-only domain controller as a physical box somewhere, at least you have that as a backup, right? And the nice thing is that, like I said, you can run that on Windows Server 2008 Core with all, like, no RAM. Like, I think ours runs, I think it's an old 512 meg, actually with an old desktop box that we're using. We just have it as a backup domain controller, just to, you know, just read-only.
And I think your point, Dana, correct me if I'm wrong, was that if people are building a virtualization machine and they're building that parent or that host machine, depending on your terminology, that they're also installing other services on there like domain controller services or Active Directory services or what have you.
Yeah, and they shouldn't be doing that because on that parent, there should be nothing installed on there. The only thing should be the Hyper-V role. That's the only component on there. And then maybe possibly, if you're using something like SCVMM, there's going to be some agents that need to be installed in the parent host. So that stuff
sure.
might need to be installed. But other than that, I wouldn't recommend that anything be installed in those parents.
I'm actually poking around on this whole offline VM patching, and it looks like the tool is called Offline Virtual Machine Servicing Tool.
A very unique name.
Yeah. No, Microsoft has a knack for really bad names.
Yeah, they always have cool code names, you know, but then all of a sudden they go away and got the, you know, the stuffy business names, but, you know, it's their business and it's worked well for them.
The acronym you can't pronounce.
Yeah, well, there you go. Or you have 50 different acronyms that all mean the different things, and but they're all the same thing.
So what else is important to be thinking about, you know, as the IT person who's security conscious, you know, in the case of what we're talking about, and we are, you know, doing virtualization for the first time, and maybe a more abstract question for you, or step back a little bit question, is I want to be able to do security better. And I want to be able to virtualize and, you know, streamline in that regard. So how do I make those two things work for each other?
Okay, well, there's a couple things that really help. Hyper-V actually has what I would consider a golden gem that very few people know about, and that is the ability to apply through ASMAN, or the Authorization Manager, an ability to apply different roles and operations to different people. One of the risks that you have when you talk about Hyper-V is that normally you have what is called the role administrator, which is pretty much the guy that has full godlike powers on that parent. And that means that they have the ability of managing and manipulating all the children. So what ends up happening is they can start and stop and modify and basically change how the behavior of any VM works. Any of the children can be controlled by that administrator. And that's not always a good thing. So with things like Authorization Manager, what this gives you the ability of doing is to apply, there's like 32 different operations that you can apply through ASMAN for Hyper-V. Things like, can you start a VM? Can you stop a VM? Do you have the ability of looking at the network properties? Do you have the ability to change the network properties? One of the really cool things that I like about Hyper-V is that in the networking side of things, you can create isolated networks. Like, you can have complete DMZs all drawn out from different NICs or even virtual NICs to the virtual switch. And what ends up happening is that you can control who has access to look at that stuff and to modify that stuff. So now all of a sudden we can have, you know, different types of administrators having different access to the VMs directly. So they could have it. So in our own organization here, you know, my developers, they have to have access. We have a box called QAVS, which is a Hyper-V box. And what we've done is apply different ASMAN roles. We have created these different roles, and then we give them to the developers. So developers can manipulate these VMs, but they can't touch the actually automated testing VMs because it would be really, really bad if they screwed up our daily automated testing framework. And we can do that by just applying those ASMAN operations for those roles to a group called developers. And then that applies it in a way and restricts it so they can only do certain things. Meanwhile, me as an administrator, I have full access, and I can determine who needs access to what, and we can do that. And then you top that off, Hyper-V Manager, which is the tool you use to manipulate and manage this, can be run from your desktop. So what's nice is you can run the Hyper-V Manager on our Vista machines, And we can literally just start it up, connect up to the Hyper-V server, and based off of what permissions we have, we can only access and manipulate from console or by RDP, however we've got it configured. And that's really, really nice. And what's sad is that not a lot of people know that it even exists from a Hyper-V point of view, because you can isolate it and control it however you fit.
Well, you definitely delineated two distinct work cases there. I mean, using VMs for development and testing is one thing. When you're using VMs in a sort of data center environment, I guess the two big roles I can see is that you want to secure independently would be the ability to spin up new VMs or relocate VMs versus actually modifying them or creating them.
Yeah, and you can do that because one of the things, so at LNC, what's interesting is that where ASMAN is applied directly in a Hyper-V server, you can go one step further. If you go and purchase Microsoft System Center Virtual Machine Manager, they also have the ability of having ASMAN and even have a self-provisioning portal that's web-based that is using the same ASMAN operations and roles. So you can actually control how people not only spin up new ones, and like you said, they can target them to different CPUs. So, you know, you can have what they call quick migration. So you can say, okay, so one of the things that I talk about, like I did at Tech Days, was talking about how you can physically separate VMs in what I call domains of trust. And what that really is that if you've got, let's say, a physical server is a production server that's internet-facing in a DMZ, let's say, that's going to have different security policies applied to it than a QA box in an isolated LAN. But what's interesting is through things like SCVMM, you could retarget it and say, okay, so I'm running on this VM right now. We're testing with it, and we're happy with it. Now we're ready to deploy it. You actually have the ability to be, depending on their permission sets and what they've done and what they're allowed to do, you can all of a sudden say, okay, I want to now deploy that VM in the production server. And what you're doing is crossing a boundary of trust when you feel or they feel, depending on their permission, that should be done. So that means I could do something as simple as, let's say I got a new Exchange 2007 box that I've got somewhere, and as part of that I have an isolated management system. I don't know. Like, so we, in our case here, we have some PowerShell stuff that's running on an old Windows Server 2008 box. I don't want that PowerShell, those scripts and everything that's running on there to be public-facing until we've audited it. And when it's time to audit it, I have the ability to say, okay, I'm now going to take it from this isolated network where we've tested it, we've made sure everything's good, I'm now going to roll it into production. Now, how do I roll it into production? I'm literally going to just do a quick migration from, you know, target A host and bring it over to target B host, which is on a different trust boundary, has a different network, and the nice thing is I can apply that, and I can apply it directly on that server through the ASMAN roles, but more importantly, I can do it directly through SCVMM based off of permissions I have.
Yeah, no, it's obviously some smart people have really thought through this problem.
Well, you know what's funny is that this is like a personal gripe I have. As a Microsoft Enterprise Security MVP, there's lots of security technology that's under the hood in the operating system
right.
that just aren't being leveraged. People don't realize this, but ASMAN's actually existed in Windows Server 2003 forever. And application vendors have had the ability to apply and use the ASMAN system. They can even create their own stores. So if they want to create their own isolated authorization controls for their applications, they could do so. Or they could leverage existing authorization controls that are in there. And why that's important is that we're coming into a world now where authentication and authorization are separated out. But more importantly, the applications need to be able to work on their own and not care about how people are being authorized or authenticated. And if they could start applying this whole aspect of using things like ASMAN and using role-based security, means that when they apply to someone to a certain role, they might get access
right.
to all these different tools. If these application vendors would apply this logic for things like ASMAN in their own apps, we would actually see a lot of benefit from that. Because that means if we provision someone out to be the role of the accounting department, and we know what's all in there. Yeah, we can apply certain things by security groups and so forth in AD, but at the end of the day, the applications themselves, because they're not aware of what those roles are, unless they specifically write to that, it's not going to work. Well, if you use something like ASMAN and you use role-based security, you can actually start applying all these other types of technology that exist out there. Like, you know, you could apply things like the Geneva Framework. You could use Active Directory Federation services. You could apply, you know, 80 domains of trust across forests because they could use a centralized ASMAN roles in the stores. And it could get really complicated, or it could be very, very simple. You could have it all centralized in one way and create these claims-based applications that could use these roles to do it all. Unfortunately, you know, Microsoft sees it in some departments, which is what we're seeing in Hyper-V, but there's lots of other departments where they're not. And then, you know, like I've always been frustrated because I think things like SharePoint should have leveraged that. If you had those proper admin roles, that means that the same roles you might apply to, you know, controls in Hyper-V might be what you'd use for publishing in certain areas in SharePoint. You know, who said you couldn't actually have configuration?
Well, and you started off this point that this particular rant saying, I wish other software developers would do this. But it's not even Microsoft that's actually doing this consistently across their product lines.
That's right. And, you know, it's funny. It's everybody. So here's the biggest thing that I think it drives me nuts just as a developer is that, and I see this too, and I'm not saying that we're perfect because, you know, although we build claimsware applications here, you know, the reality is we could probably do it better if we could leverage the same ecosystem and system that other people are using. But the reality is this, is that whenever you design systems and software, you need to leverage whatever the operating system has to your advantage for security. So we see from, you know, vulnerable software applications that simply, you know, don't use things like proper ACLs. They're not locking down stuff, even though Microsoft has a great way of locking file access down. We see things like the whole reason UAC was born was because people, quite frankly, developers were lazy and they would just say, oh, I'm just going to write directly to the registry in ways I shouldn't do. Because I can. And, you know, UAC all of a sudden put it in our face right. As developers. Whoa, you're writing someplace that's considered privileged, and you shouldn't be allowed to do that.
After how many years of being told, only write to the user's portion of the registry, not the machine portion of the registry. Don't write to System32. Don't write directly to program files.
Right.
Now we're finally enforcing all that.
That's right. Or, you know, let's look at it from an IT perspective. How many times do we see IT administrator installing applications and then putting the document folders or basically what is going to be considered the user data in the same friggin' program files directory? And what do? They just go and change the ACL and say full read and write control. And it's like, it drives me nuts that they do that. And, you know, when designing security, either from our designing applications, you know, from developer side or even from an IT pro side, we got to use the infrastructure that's there. And the reason is that, number one, it's audited way better than some of the half-baked stuff that I see people do. And the second thing is that if you leverage the operating system pieces, so everything from using the right crypto libraries. I hear about guys having vulnerabilities in their applications because they wrote their own crypto library. It's like, you realize Microsoft's audited and done all this already. Why would you use somebody else's stuff? Or we see people that are saying, okay, well, I'm just going to write directly to program files because I own that folder, so I have rights to add privileges, whatever I want. I sit there and go, okay, well, that's just you not caring or being too lazy to do it right. And, you know, a lot of people think of USC as a security mechanism. I don't. I think of USC as a warning to allow people to realize they're running crappy software. That's not my view.
That's a good point.
And at the end of the day, we're actually seeing, at least on the MVP side, we're actually seeing a significant reduction in even things like UAC prompts because developers are starting to realize, maybe we need to write safer. You know, Microsoft brings out lots of tools from Visual Studio down to the installer tools to make it a little better and easier. They have an SDL process that's helping train people to do it better. As IT pros, we also need to apply the same kind of logic. So we need to be using ACLs properly. We need to be using things like ASMAN. We need to be using Active Directory more efficiently. And Hyper-V, at least, they saw that, and they've applied that knowledge into that. And we just need to get more people using Hyper-V to know that that even exists.
I do think you are a bit of an idealist here. We're just trying to get past everybody as an administrator to you're an administrator or you're just a regular user. You're now talking about granularity within the administrator set of rights. You're just I think you're a dreamer, Dana.
No, you don't have to be a dreamer. So let's use a perfect example here. Because I know you obviously do lots of interviews and talk with lots of developers. And what's the first thing a developer does whenever he's got his own box? He requires that he has full administrative rights so that he can code. Why is that? Because in Visual Studio, they need to have administrative rights. That's a load of bull. I run as a standard user. I don't run as administrator. If I need that, I elevate to run as administrator and get an actual prompt and type in my administrative credentials. But if I wasn't an administrator, I could still get my work done. And the reason is that because 9 times out of 10, when you're doing development, you do not need administrative rights. In areas where you think you need administrative rights, that's just a policy change. You could just change it. Maybe you need enough permissions to register a COM interop. If you're writing, let's say, some COM components, you need to write to the registry. You could apply a control for that. Maybe you need to have some privileges to do certain things. Okay, well, do the system support that? In the case we're talking Hyper-V here, if I need to spin up a VM, I just need to have permissions to spin up the VM. I don't need to have complete administrative rights. The problem is that we always think of that security as a burden. right? We think of it as a position where it's going to burden me. I don't want it. I'm a developer or I'm an IT guy. I need full control. And that's not what should happen. Least privilege, which is what we're really talking about here, giving just enough privilege to do your job. You will never see security. You'll never see things pop up unless you do something you're not supposed to. If you start getting these blocks, that means that as the security administrators, they haven't done their job to make that right or work, or they haven't been screaming at the right people. As an example, I for years have been yelling at Microsoft telling them that I think they've designed Visual Studio wrong. I think they should be isolating out these tools to do things like registering things, bringing up the debugger to connect up to IIS. Those should be done in smaller tools that can be isolated and elevated in their own right. And things like your friggin' editor should not need administrative privileges so you can do things. That's just design decisions that they've done. And I believe they're wrong, but that's my opinion because I'm a security geek. And quite frankly, you're right, I'm an idealist. At the end of the day, though, 9 times out of 10, when people say they need administrative rights, they don't. They're just thinking it's easier to get around so they don't have to do anything. And that's just a wrong attitude, and it's got to change.
Right. You could call it a laziness problem as well.
It is, but it's a reality, right? People want to get their job done. Computers are there to let them do their job. And when they go and put something like a UAC prompt every time they try to, I don't know, do something like, it's kind of funny. I was actually talking to a guy recently who was complaining about Vista, and he didn't like it because there's all these UAC prompts. And I said, okay, well, are you actually running Vista? And the funny thing was, he's only saw it. He never actually run it. So I gave him a free copy because as an MVP, I got buckets of dollars for buying Vista licenses. And so I gave him a free, a license of Vista Ultimate. And he comes back a month later and he's complaining to me and he's saying, look, you know what? Okay, it's not as bad as I thought it was. It actually is pretty good. But there's some really stupid things, like, why do I have to elevate to flush my DNS? And I said, because that's a privileged operation. Yeah, but I shouldn't need to do that. And I'm like, okay, let me ask you this. How many times do you flush your DNS? You know, and all of a sudden he's like, well, that's not the point. I go, no, that is the point. You know, if you want to do a privileged operation, yeah, you need to elevate. Okay, it's not hard. You just, you know, right-click and bring up your command window and type, ipconfig/flushdns, and it'll work fine. But the reality is, it's not an operation you're doing every day. I haven't seen a UAC prompt probably in 2-3 weeks. And I think that was because I didn't install something.
Right.
You know, and the reality is, if it's designed right, I run as a standard user, not as an administrator. I've got the right privileges to do the things I need to do, and I never see these problems. And that comes down to how IT administrators administer and apply security policy across their network.
The old adage, Dana, that, you know, there are no technology problems, there are really only people problems, you know, kind of applies here. That applies whether it's the people who are designing the technology or the people who are deploying it or the people who are using it. The taking the short, easy way out.
Yeah. And the thing is that the weakest link in security is the human factor anyway. So it doesn't matter how well you deploy it, there will always be somebody that's going to find some different way that it's going to block them or get them around it. And what you got to do, the idea is that everyone's got to get aligned and say, you know what, security is for the betterment of our company, or for our users, or for everything. So we need to use it to protect us, but we also can't have it be a burden that's stopping us from getting our job done. And, you know, IT administrators' job should be to let them do their job.
I think if we do security really well, then it enables us to do our jobs better.
That's right. And even the really good thing is, if you do security well, no one will know. Because that's the whole idea. If you do it right, they're never going to be confronted with it unless they do something they're not supposed to.
Well, that's a whole different topic. You know, on the virtualization thing, before we let you go, there's one recurring question that I've hear come up all the time. And you sort of have this, it's the apocalypse of virtual machines where, you know, you have an organization where, you know, the great thing about virtualization is that it's easy to spin up a virtual machine and I can do it quickly. But the terrible thing about virtualization is that it's so easy to spin up virtual machines and I can do it so quickly. You end up with virtual machines that are sitting around stagnant that somebody then goes and grabs. They're taking up tons and tons of storage space. Is there a really good, actual, workable, solid answer to dealing with just the onslaught of VMs?
Yeah, well, actually, the way we do it here is that we use proper network isolation with VLAN. So if someone brings up a VM that we have not authorized, it's isolated in a way that it's not going to be able to do much. We use NAT policy, so pretty much anything that comes up on the network will not be allowed to talk with our AD, not be able to do anything, will be quarantined and isolated off in a place so that, can I prevent someone from bringing up a VM? No, of course not. But can I prevent that VM from doing anything or communicating with our organization? Damn straight I can. Not only can I do that through IPsec policy and do that through just standard networking, I've got VLAN controls, I've got physical switch controls, I have the ability to make sure that that's not going to pollute our network, or worse yet, go out and pollute other people's networks, because I'm liable.
Sure.
When, you know, I let's say someone brings in a VM that infects this organization, I'm liable for that. If that then goes outbound to the rest of the internet, you know, as a good netizen, I don't want to allow that. And that's where things like the Threat Management Gateway allow me to, you know, people need to be logged in before they even get out of our network. And
but this is the same as if a foreign laptop comes into the network.
Exactly. If someone comes and plugs in a laptop into our network, it gets isolated. There's nothing that they can do to get on our network to do anything. Is it perfect? No. There's always going to be something to get out there. But there's lots of cool new technology that exists. And not just because it's cool, but because it was designed in a way that makes sense. Things like NAP, it's a built-in role that you can apply directly on Windows Server 2008, and guess what? It costs you nothing.
There's a great security synergy between NAP and Hyper-V here that I don't think it's really been explored enough yet.
No, and so when we're talking about spinning up VMs, like, the funny thing is that nothing. What prevents someone from downloading the free virtual PC, installing it on their laptop as a user? They don't even need administrative rights for that side of it. And then spinning up a VM inside there. Well, there's nothing. So they can bring up a little Linux box that can, you know, that can automatically start hacking the network. But in our case, what we do is that it's a foreign IP that's not connected to the domain. So TMG, the Threat Management Gateway, is just going to just say, I don't know what this is. We will keep that isolated over there until they log in. And that gives us at least some control. Now, I have to say, you know, we're always talking about me being idealist. The reality is I only have to manage about, you know, 50 to 60 nodes on this network, so it's very small. In comparison to, you know, big networks that got thousands and thousands of nodes to manage. So, yeah, I realize that. But on the flip side of it is, outside of the technology we can apply, there's also, you know, human heuristics and, more importantly, human training. Quite frankly, anyone who brings up a VM in our network that's not on the QAVS box, which is our only, what we call, it's an isolated VM network, basically. If we find out about it, then we're going to, you know, we're going to have words, and that's an HR problem. It's an HR problem. That's
you
not
don't
a technology
want to make data
problem,
angry.
Right? We try our best to defend against it, but in the case someone does bring that up, we need to account for it. And that's just, that's life. That's saying, like, we have wireless here. It's isolated in its own subnet. And, you know, the theory is, I've seen employees bring in their own laptops to, you know, at lunch, go play Guild Wars or, you know, do whatever. Do whatever you want. Just don't put that included in our network. You know, and within reason, but, you know, and we make sure that, you know, we teach them, if you're going to bring up stuff and do that stuff, you need to do it, you know, on a mature light, and we have to watch it. And that's a human heuristic. That's an HR problem, not a technology one.
Dana, always fun to talk to you, man.
Sure. Appreciate it.
Hey, no problem. Thanks for having me on.
And we'll see you next time on Run As Radio.